So I'm going to talk about high availability networking in AWS VPC. So can I get just a show of hands, like how many of you are on AWS? And how many of you are in VPC on AWS? And how many of you are not in VPC on AWS? Okay. So two of you. All right. So just a little bit about who I am. So I'm an infrastructure hacker at SignalFX. We just launched on Thursday. You may or may not have heard of us. We had a lot of tech press and whatnot go out, but pretty good place to work. 12 years of experience in tech. That's if you count like post-college experience. And 3 years hacking on AWS, trying to make it do what I want, which is still very, very difficult. I've worked at different companies like Google and FedEx and Uyala and now SignalFX, of course. And again, just thank you guys for coming, and I hope this is useful. And here we go. So I'll be talking a little bit about the traditional, like how AWS traditionally says to set up your VPC. I'm going to talk about some of my requirements that I wanted for a solution that did not fulfill, and I'll talk about some details of my solution, and then I'll also talk about how we take that solution and then kind of extend it a little bit to make it easier for to deal with other parts of our infrastructure. It's also worth noting that I'll be throwing around a lot of AWS acronyms. I'll try to define them as I go. If for any reason that you feel like I missed one, please just kind of get my attention and let me know, and I'll try to go over that. And at the end, I'll take Q&A. So if your question is, if you would like to ask questions, please feel free to do so. All right. So one thing to note, so this is the traditional VPC design. And one of the things that you'll notice is in VPC, I'm kind of taking a lot of liberties here because what actually happens is you're in a subnet. That subnet, this is the public-private subnet version of a VPC, and in the private subnet, it's where you generally keep your server instances. You have a subnet that is set up just for NAT routers, and a NAT router in this case is just a special AMI that or a special instance that is running a special version of the Amazon Linux AMI that handles the special version of NAT that they do. And then that public subnet is going to be connected to the IGW or the Internet Gateway. Just for the record, it is possible to connect multiple VPCs inside a region with like direct layer 3 connectivity, but that's not possible across regions. So if you're connecting from US East 1 to US West 2, you don't get the ability to ping from one host to another without doing some work on your own. I'm going to talk a little bit about the NAT router itself is, of course, a single point of failure in this scenario. There's some ways to deal with that, which I'll talk about in a bit. There's no quick failover for the NAT router failure. You can kind of get closer to that, but it's still not a really great story. And those are my primary beefs with it. The no layer 3 networking between hosts in different regions. In addition to like solving some of those issues, my design had some other criteria. Most of these are about availability or not being too rigid in the design. I don't want to bore you with too many of the details, but one of the important things is that the way that we use the system should not make it impossible for us to take advantage of the cost differences. Talking between AZs, for example, is more expensive than talking within a single AZ, things like that. And also latency increases if you're talking across AZs rather than in the same AZ. So the idea is to expose that in some way to the users, but still be able to make it simple enough to use. And my users, in my case, my users are my developers, right? So a lot of this has to do with, enabling those users to self-service and spin up hosts, spin up LBs, spin up all the things that they need to do in their jobs. And this is my onion of abstractions. I guess everyone needs one, so here's mine. I'm going to briefly discuss the naming, how they map to AWS concepts. So we have regions, And the way that I name regions is basically with the provider plus the region. So for AWS US East 1, it's just that hyphenated together just so that I have a unique string that identifies it. There's the culture, which is identified with two letters, two arbitrary letters, and the cell, which is identified with two letters of the culture in which it belongs and two letters that are just arbitrary. And the idea here is, a developer looking at this and trying to decide how to make their application available needs to make sure that they have their application spread across cultures, spread across cells, whatever. So the cells can include front-end or back-end services or both. From an infra perspective, the cells are the level at which maintenance occurs. So when a cell is degraded, that could affect production traffic in that cell, and it's very similar to a data center in the traditional sense. Cells roughly correspond to and are completely contained inside a single AZ, so a single availability zone. So within, if there's a single AZ failure, it will affect any cells that are in that AZ. And cells communicating at the same to the same culture have higher performance than cells in different cultures, and that's because inside a VPC, when you connect from one subnet to another, if those subnets are in the same availability zone, it's going to be lower latency, less cost than if you connect to another availability zone, higher latency, higher cost, slightly. And multiple cultures can exist in a single region, and there may be a number of different reasons why you'd want to do this. Most of them boil down to you find a scaling problem in EC2, or you find an administrative reason, like maybe HIPAA compliance or something like that. My company is not a HIPAA company, so that's not our particular concern. There may be other reasons that I haven't thought of yet. First things first, we'll start with the, I guess I should tell you, this is kind of, the cell is like the culture of cells in like a petri dish. That's kind of where the names come from. So, all right, so the routing and the front end subnets, when you're building out the cell in AWS, the objects that you have to worry about most are the routing subnet, the front end subnet, and the private instance subnet. The routing and front-end instance subnets use the Internet Gateway as their default route, making them public subnets in AWS. So in AWS, when you're talking about subnets, those subnets are associated with the routing table. The routing table for these subnets includes the IGW as its default route, meaning that it can have a public IP address. Like that, that's how you get a public IP address in VPC. The private instance will use a NAT instance's NIC in order for its default route. So the way that this happens in AWS is your packet goes into the ether of the AWS network, and then AWS sends that to the NIC of your instance that's serving as your NAT. And if you want any more details about those, about some of these AWS specific details, I'm gonna try to push these to the question and answer session, I guess. All of the instances in these subnets will be able to use the Amazon network to directly communicate, which is really important because when you're in a single VPC, even if you're talking across AZs, that may cost a little more, but that's going to cost less and be less and have less latency than talking across regions. And in order to make sure that that's reflected in the model, there's another level on top of the cells called cultures. Since all the instances are in a single AZ, all right. So once we have cells built, then we can look at a bigger level. That's where the cultures come in. The cultures more or less correspond to a VPC in Amazon, and they're meant to provide a container for a number of different AZs that you want to administer together in one network. So VPC allows you to have a lot of control over like network numbering and things like that. The cells themselves are kind of different administrative zones. So Each cell's routing network is connected to the IGW. So the routing subnet, remember I said the routing and the front-end subnets are both connected to the IGW. Because the routing subnets are connected to the IGW, that allows them to send traffic out to the internet. So there will have to be some instance in the routing subnet that acts as a NAT router. This doesn't change from the traditional design, although how it works does change. All right. And another thing is that you can have multiple cultures, you can have cultures in other regions, or you can have multiple cultures. So, as I pointed out before, you really can't see the background, but this is circled, and the culture AA and AB are both in the same region. AWS US East 1, BB is in AWS US West 2. Those will have their routing subnets that are connected to the internet via the IGW again, and that connection over the internet will allow them to have access to one another. So all of the routers have to have public IP addresses. All right, and of course you can also throw in a corp VPN just for fun. So, you know, all my developers need to get to the different machines. They connect to a corp VPN, which provides them access to all of the different regions. They can log into, you know, whatever locate, wherever that machine is. All right, so let's see. So here's where it gets a little more interesting. So the edge routers are routers that are responsible for NATing traffic to the internet. So these are kind of like, if you look back to the design for the traditional design, there's one NAT router. The ER is kind of like the NAT router in that case, except that it has more responsibilities. So the private subnet route table, its default route is going to be connected to the elastic NIC connected to one of the edge routers. The other edge router is a cold standby, so when you fail over to that other router, you may have to reestablish any stateful connections. So think like TCP connections, or if you're in the middle of a ping, it may get angry at you for not keeping the same sequence number. There's a lot of little things that can have hiccups. And so in our infrastructure, we do a lot of retries and whatnot. So once a failover happens, we just keep it stateless. It is possible to add in contract D. I don't know if you've dealt with this, but it allows you to capture that state information and publish it over to another machine. And the obvious utility of that is that you can have a warm failover. It's really just a matter of how far you need to go with it. So failing over to the other router is just a matter of removing the NIC from one machine, connecting it to the other. So the Amazon NAT AMI handles this to some degree, although it doesn't handle it quite how you'd expect. So I've actually taken the NAT AMIs and I've cut my own AMIs that cut out their scripts and use some modified scripts to set up the NATing and all of the things that you would need to set up if you threw a network card into a machine while it's running, because it looks like a PCI hot plug. So once that's done though, the router, like you can actually have a ping running, and even though it may miss a couple pings while the failover is happening, it will pick right back up after the failover is complete. And the standby router, I already said that, sorry. Really bad about that. All right, so let's see. The IRs, which are the interior routers, are basically responsible for some key parts of inter-cell routing, so between different cells. I'll talk about those in a minute. With regard to the setup, so this is the networking that you find, like when you look at a cell, you're going to find a lot of objects that are created. So all of those objects that are created are to basically build up a full mesh between the IRs and the ERs. The full mesh is needed because of the way that the routing works, which I'll discuss in a second. To make all of this work, like Amazon doesn't let you normally run, BGP, like OSPF, that type of protocol on their network. So there's an overlay network that is created on top of this mesh, and the way that it works is something like this. So I create dummy interfaces that have certain RFC 6598 addresses, which is carrier grade NAT. Carrier grade NAT is 100.64/0/0/10. 10, I think. It's a part of the address space that was separated out so that large providers could NAT their networks while not having to worry about conflicting with RFC 1918 space. It's pretty likely that Amazon uses this on their internal networks because they do not allow this type of network address to traverse their, like, you cannot send this to another machine. So in order to get around that problem, I put IP-IP tunnels between each of the machines to get a static, like, you know, RFC 6598 address. I then use OSPF to advertise intermediate space, so also RFC 6598, just a different address. And then I use internal BGP over that intermediate space for the peering. The ERs handle all, basically the ERs, like I said, they're responsible for NAT, so they handle all non-RFC 1918 addresses, the next hop for those addresses is going to be the IGW. So if you're going to, some external IP address, it'll hit that. The ERs pass all RFC 1918 traffic to the IRs, which route it to the IRs and other cells. So basically, I've reserved all of RFC 1918 space for internal use so that whenever you see that, you know that it's not going on the internet, so it shouldn't be handled by, it should not be passed out onto the internet, and it also is straight up blocked by the routers. They will only forward it to other, to the IRs. And the ERs are also, part of that RFC 1918 space may be the Corp VPN router, of course. Okay, so the IRs are connected to one another over the internet. So this is back to they're connected to the IGWs. They have public IP addresses. And the, so they're connected over the internet to one another, and the way that works is they have IPsec tunnels set up between each of the different machines. So, there's a lot of tunnels going on here to hide a lot of these addresses from Amazon. But once you get to this point, so now we have a redundant connection between cells. So you can see that there's one connection to each from each IR in each cell to both of the other IRs in each cell. And this allows you to basically get that communication. So now, we also, remember I mentioned that inside a cell we're using internal BGP, that's why you need a full mesh. Outside the cells, we're actually, like from cell to cell, we're using external BGP. So we're using private ASNs, autonomous system numbers, so that you can basically pass routing information between the cells. And there is a discussion about whether you should do it at the cultural level or the cell level. It's really a matter of what kind of failure domain that you want. So in our instance, we connect everything from one cell to another so that a complete cell can be, So we rely on Amazon for the IGW, so there's not much to say, there's not much of a way that we can make sure that that's physically not happening. Really what this is meant to deal with is if, for whatever reason the IPsec connection gets messed up, if the, it's also meant to not have an unencrypted protocol just over the internet. Like, these are all internal details, so I guess the short answer is we can't, but we rely on Amazon for that, so. And of course, the IRs are connected to each other internally because they're connected to each other in the intra-cell routing, and they actually do, they actually define, if you know much about BGP, they define communities and all of the fun, fantastical words that you would use to kind of segregate off certain parts of the IP address space so that the things that are supposed to be in the cell end up in the cell. The things that are, supposed to be on the edge of the cell do get broadcast correctly, because there's a lot of details here that I'm kind of skipping that I'll try to go into in a minute. Once you have the cells linked up with one another, you can pass that routing information and you can pass that routing information between them, and now you have basically a redundant, more or less a redundant setup that has some ability to, you know, to reroute traffic on its own when you're dealing with traffic going from one cell to another. You might notice that if we go back to roughly here, the ERs are where all of the traffic goes in for the NATing. So one of the problems that we haven't solved yet, which it hasn't become a major problem yet, but the traffic that's destined for the internet hits the ERs, but so does all the traffic that's destined for another cell. So it'll go ER, IR, and then the other cell. That traffic could be eliminated. You could skip the hop to the ER if you were to take basically your BGP route tables and synchronize those into an Amazon route table. Currently, we don't do that because it just hasn't been a big issue. But if we get to a point where, like, you know, scaling the network becomes an issue, I'm sure that we would do that very quickly. So basically, the way that this is all set up is I use a lot of CloudFormation for this. This is a lot of EC2 specific or AWS specific technology because cloud. So I use CloudFormation. CloudFormation is basically an orchestration layer for AWS, and it has a lot of knowledge in it. So like when you tell it to construct like a security group and add rules to that security group, it knows that it has to wait for that security group to be completed, you know, for that creation to be completed before it can start adding rules. And just little things like that, or, you know, getting that right in a script doesn't seem worth it when they already have that set up. So basically what I write is I have a Python script that generates that config based on certain configuration parameters. So when I'm spinning up a culture, for example, I have to tell it, what the subnet of that culture is and what the name of that culture is. When I spin up a cell, I have to tell it what the subnet of that cell is and then what the name of that cell is, and then it will make sure that it's, like, from the name, it'll make sure that it's in the right, in a correct subnet for that culture, and it will, like, kind of a lot of the configuration gets either verified or generated because it's in a particular culture. So it'll generate like the right security groups, for example, so that like only traffic that is, you know, destined for that cell is actually allowed into machines in that cell. So I use Python and Troposphere lib and Bodo lib. Those are just a couple of libs that are useful for CloudFormation and interacting with the Amazon APIs. The cultures and cells are managed by separate tools. So as I was saying, I have, you know, a way to spin up a culture, a way to spin up a cell. Those are actually different tools, but they rely on a common lib, and that's how a lot of the configuration can propagate between them. So when I create a culture with the culture tool, and then I go and create a cell config tool, I have to tell it a name. That name can be used to identify the culture, and there's a lot of information that's just pulled right out of Amazon from that cultural config to make sure, so that the user doesn't have to try to generate, you know, the same kind of data multiple times. It's just you enter it once, you set up the thing, and then the thing is, and then that config flows down to the other objects. There's some things that need to be kept track of course. So you heard me mentioning things like intermediate addresses and dummy interfaces and all of these IP addresses have to be registered somewhere. So the idea is that a user should be able to, you know, ping from one host to another, from one cell to another, and yeah, there may be some additional latency, but there won't be like just a layer 3 block. Like, you have layer 3 connectivity from host to host throughout our entire infrastructure. And that means that you're not having to implement, you know, I have worked at other companies where the strategy was to run an HA proxy on both sides, in both regions, and then have every service plumb through that HA proxy. I think that is really difficult for developers to deal with, and it really makes them have to solve issues that I think are, you know, the network layer was meant to solve. So this whole infrastructure was designed to make sure that we had layer 3 connectivity end to end, not having to, you know, pretend like, even though we're using RFC 1918 addresses, there's no NATing as far as the hosts are concerned. Like, you know, there is as far as like getting across the tunnels and whatnot, but once you look at the network fabric that is on, you know, the overlay network, there's just, it's I would like to think that it's very nice for the developers not to have to worry about that, but at least for me, it makes it easier to troubleshoot when something goes wrong. Because it's usually not that overlay network. It's usually, you know, server's not configured properly, or, you know, a firewall rule is out of place, something like that. The routing protocols are all implemented in Quagga. You know, I'd like to try Bird. I saw the Fastly talk earlier today. I don't know if any of you saw that. And like a lot of this has to do with like we need routing like to do some of these problems. So I'm using Quagga. We're using Amazon Linux. That's why we're using Quagga, because Quagga is very easily available. There's probably a lot of work that could be done to, you know, improve that side of the equation. All right, so here's a couple of interesting numbers. Like once everything is said and done, once you spin up a culture in a cell, so a cell is composed of 86 individual AWS objects when running with two IRs and two ERs, so that you're redundant. Those 86 objects would have to be created by hand and maintained by hand, or by a script or something. If you were to create them by without going through CloudFormation, it turns into a very long JSON description. It's something like, I think, about 700 lines or something. It's pretty crazy once it gets all expanded, but it's actually quite manageable within the scripts, because they will, when you're updating a cell, when you need to update the configuration, it'll pull config that has already been set in the cell, and unless you're overriding it, like say the number of IRs, it'll know that they're, like if you have two, it'll know that which two exist, and it will actually allow you to just reuse that config without having to manually specify. And there are some ways to override some of those settings so that you can do things like decommission routers, institute new routers, spin up new routers, stuff like that. The culture is composed of 22 AWS objects, and that includes things like, a bastion network to, be able to, to be able to have kind of a backdoor if something goes wrong with the VPN, and to provide but really that's the only instance at the cultural level. Everything else kind of exists at the cellular level, and the cell is kind of, it's like I said before, it's the unit of maintenance. So like when I say that I'm going to degrade, say, BBAA, on Thursday, then people that are running their applications in BBAC and any of the other cells even within the same culture should be relatively insulated from one another. There's obviously more risk to the culture than there is to another culture, but that's kind of, when you're planning your availability, it lets, like when I say something's going under maintenance, it gives the developers like an idea of like what they need to prepare for. So, and in most cases, unless an error is made, it's just that one cell that gets taken out, so. All right, so these numbers include every little AWS object that must be created. So think like security groups have a bunch of rules in them. I create like three or four security groups, each of which with like three or four rules. So some of these objects are those rules, but a lot of these are, like the instances for the routers, the instance profiles and the roles for the routers, things like that. So it's a lot of little details just to get this done. And then once you have this set up, though, I mean, there are benefits that go beyond just the cell, just the idea of conceptualizing cell and culture, because now my developers do not have to worry about things, because we have a tool that kind of backs up all of this. We don't have to worry about making sure that people are using the right AMIs. We just bake that into the tool. So when you go and you fire up a new instance, we have both cell and culture aware tools to spin up and terminate instances and load balancers. So this allows the developers to basically self-serve on the most common pieces of Amazon infrastructure that you need, which are hosts and LBs in our case. These tools integrate with our Salt deployment to make it easier for a developer to self-service when spinning up a new type of instance. And basically what that means is like when you spin up an instance in, say, the web server service, Salt has some concept of what the web server service is, and it may do something like install the Docker daemon to make sure that you're able to deploy your Docker containers on it. And these are just examples of the command lines that we would use to either spin up a host or spin up an LB. There are additional pieces of these commands to do things. Like on the LBs, of course, you need to be able to add and remove backends. And the hosts, of course, you need to be able to, you know, control the life cycles to terminate those instances. If you're on EBS instances, then you're going to have to be able to start and stop instances. You need to be able to reboot them. And all of that's done with kind of like, even though it's built on AWS, it's done with kind of an AWS agnostic approach. So when I add a host for web server, it may be web server 1-BBAA. That may be the actual like name that we call it in our system. And if someone wants to refer to that system, there is a way to refer to the Amazon IDs, of course, and of course you could call the APIs directly, but our system kind of goes out of its way to make sure that those names are unique across our whole system. So if we ever do spin up a culture and a cell in another type of environment, like maybe Google or, you know, Azure or whatever, the idea is that most of these concepts would translate over and you'd be able to use the same tools to spin up in all those environments. And really the thing that you have to be worried about is, like, as a developer, you know, am I distributed across cultures? Am I distributed across, you know, the cells in a way that makes me feel comfortable with my app? If you care about geography in terms of, like, being close to users, there is a little bit of a cognitive burden there in that you have to, you know, figure out which cells are, you know, which cells and cultures are close to your users. But that seemed like a trade-off worth making. So that's what we did. And that's most of it. So I work for Signal Effects. We launched last week. Come see us at our booth. And are there any questions? So, we currently have it all in Amazon. Yeah. So the tools are written to be somewhat agnostic. So there's a lot of abstraction, but it's not perfect because we are only in Amazon. So some of the tools, even though the concepts are not necessarily Amazon specific, the implementation may be. So it is kind of hard to get away from that when you don't have like the forcing function of actually needing it. So, but I've gone out of my way to kind of make sure that that the concepts are generic enough that they should translate. Yes.
So did I miss you? You said a culture was a VPC and a cell was a single availability zone?
Okay, so a culture is a set of, right, it is a single availability zone. It is a set of subnets in that availability zone. So.
So what I thought was weird was that you had to do a VPN across those two subnets to the same VPC.
You do not. So the way that that works, because of the way that VPC works, once you hit that Amazon Magic Network, if you're hitting another internal address on one of those machines that's inside the same culture, it will not go through the routers. So that's why the culture exists, is to make sure that that happens so that you get that direct communication within the culture. Does that make sense? All right. Yes. So we haven't seen a lot of failures in this, although when we do see them, it's typically like me doing something stupid, so which has happened. Like there have been a couple times where I've either created routing loops because I have the wrong policy applied, you know, to the BGP, to the route maps, or that's certainly happened. It doesn't happen that often, but when it does, it's pretty terrible. All right. Do I have any numbers on how this affects latency? So one thing that I didn't go too into, so let me go back to one of these diagrams here. So you can see how all of this is going. This is just talking about the routing, but our front-end services, so when you're in the front-end subnet, the front-end subnet also has public IP addresses, so we're running things like HAProxy in there mainly. And what happens is, like, if a packet comes from the AWS network to the front end, then that front end can talk directly over the Amazon network to whatever back end. So the latency is as bad as running an HAProxy that is directly connected to the back end. It actually doesn't go through the routing infrastructure at all for that. The routing infrastructure is only used for outbound internet traffic and for cross-cell traffic. So if you have, you know, if you're going from one cell to another, then it'll have to use the routing infrastructure, but for normal traffic, it's just LB to instance back to LB out. So it seems to be pretty good. We haven't had any major problems that I'm aware of with the latency with that. So, yes?
So for the IPsec tunnels between the regions, are you using like Purpose One or some other?
I'm using, I think it's StrongSwan that we're using right now. It's the, basically, CentOS makes open, or StrongSwan very easy to use, so that's what we use. Yes? I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. We have had some issues where some of the tunnels are occasionally unstable. It seems it happens rare enough that it hasn't been a major issue, but it's probably something that we would need to address at some point. Like, there have been times where, you know, it seems to be just running fine for a really long time, then all of a sudden goes down for no, what I can tell, good reason. But just to give you an idea, so one of the reasons, so I mean, one of the things that I went through when I was trying to do this, I tried to implement it over OpenVPN instead. So one of the problems is because so many machines are connecting to each other, and because they're connecting to so many other machines to make that mesh happen, with OpenVPN, you have to open a UDP port and coordinate that among all of the machines, whereas with IPsec, it's like one UDP port. Or you can use the protocol, depending on how you want to implement it. But the idea being that, like, I don't have to worry about opening so much up. It's just one port. Much, much easier to deal with in that respect, which is why it's that way. So, does that answer?
Yeah. All right. I'm just curious, because we've been seeing weird rekeying situations where it will get the request to rekey before it gets to the leak of the model, and then it'll get the delete after that, and it'll just...
Yeah, like I said, we've seen it like where the connection will come up and then disappear after a while, and like it hasn't been enough of a problem yet to actually track down and fix it for good, but I agree. Right now we have basically two cultures that we're working on. Our production traffic is only out of one culture right now, and which is probably part of the reason why it hasn't been a problem enough yet. So it will probably be a problem like soonish, right? Yeah. Oh, sorry about that. Okay. Did everyone hear him? There's the microphone right there.
What do you feel about generating this CloudFront configuration? I don't know, and then you have an intermediate step where CloudFront config is generated. Is there a particular library that you use, or did you have to kind of do your own?
For cloud formation?
Yeah.
Troposphere. So Troposphere is a really good library for just kind of... It provides a lot of function calls that basically translate into like the different objects, and then it makes it's a lot easier than writing straight up JSON. I'm sure it could still be a lot better, but it makes it a lot less painful because it'll also do things like make sure that when you submit, it'll do some minimal checks to make sure that like you're using fields in the right way. Like there are some things that are really difficult for it to check, like if only one field or the other can exist, but it will make sure that if a field is straight up required, that it's in your JSON book, and it'll tell you which one's missing before you are allowed to submit that off and try to make that work. That is an open source library, yep. It's on the slides. I should post those somewhere. I don't know if we have a certain place where those are going. All right, any more questions? All right, well, thank you guys very much for coming, and that was useful.